The BBC's Unvaccinated, The Pandemic Dataset, Part 3. Published August 16, 2022, by Ian Davis. Narrated by Carrie Butler. In Part 1, we looked at the propaganda and manipulation techniques used throughout the BBC program Unvaccinated with Professor Hannah Fry. In Part 2, we considered the undisclosed conflicts of interest that apparently led some of the BBC's chosen experts to make some misleading statements. Yet perhaps the greatest single deception of all was in the BBC press release announcing the program, which read, quote, "Professor Hannah Fry is a British mathematician who worked on the data that helped bring the UK out of its first lockdown," end quote. This was incredibly disingenuous of the BBC. On the contrary, Professor Fry worked on the data that helped put the UK into lockdown. She was a major contributor to what became known globally as the BBC Pandemic Dataset, which, as we shall see, was central to creating of the myth of a pandemic. Central, that is, to creating a pseudo-pandemic. The pseudo-pandemic. Absent the perception of a pandemic, there could have been no possible justification to advocate for a universal vaccination campaign. Yet, from the start, many scientists pointed out that there was little to no evidence to substantiate the WHO's declaration of a, quote, global pandemic, end quote. There was virtually no asymptomatic transmission. There was no proof that children were at risk or presented an infection risk. In the UK, the average age of mortality with COVID-19 was 82, at a time when the average age of mortality from life, all cause, was 81 for men and 83 for women. Such evidence was ignored by the BBC, and Professor Fry, who maintained that the global pandemic necessitated mass vaccination. People in the UK widely believed that the pseudo-pandemic was real, not because the scientific or statistical evidence was clear, but because the government spent billions with PR firms to run, quote, hard-hitting, unquote, media campaigns designed to convince them of it. This intense propaganda, combined with the censoring or deplatforming of any scientist or expert who questioned the COVID-19 narrative and/or the COVID vaccine narrative, ensured that the general public never learned the real, relevant facts about either the disease or the jab. The vast majority who believed the pandemic was real were willing to accept a government policy response that, prior to the vaccine rollout, was based upon non-pharmaceutical interventions, NPIs. Lockdowns, social distancing, mask wearing, and track and trace are all examples of NPIs. Even if the pseudo-pandemic were not pseudo, but a genuine pandemic, which it wasn't, the NPIs deployed by the UK government would have been justified only in the most extreme circumstances. In 2019, The WHO published a piece titled, quote, "Non-Pharmaceutical Public Health Measures for Mitigating the Risk and Impact of Epidemic and Pandemic Influenza," end quote. In it, The WHO concluded that lockdowns, the, quote, "quarantining of healthy individuals," unquote, were, quote, "not recommended because there is no obvious rationale for this measure," end quote. The WHO also advised that social isolation for the sick should be done only for a limited period of time. It did not recommend isolation for, quote, "individuals who need to seek medical attention," end quote. It ruled out work closures because of their destructive impact on the economy. The WHO advised shutting down business activity only in, quote, "extraordinarily severe pandemics," end quote. The WHO found, quote, unquote, "no obvious rationale for contact tracing, test and trace." It did not recommend the widespread use of face masks for, quote, "there was no evidence that this is effective in reducing transmission," end quote. The prevailing epidemiological understanding was that lockdowns and other NPIs were largely counterproductive. Yet, in defiance of the WHO's statements and rationale, governments around the world willfully pushed these NPI measures on their citizens just a few months later. It would not be long before the so-called science emerged to back up these policy decisions. One of the first was reported by Flaxman et al. In 2020. It was funded, not surprisingly, by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, BMGF, and the U.S. government. Based on pandemic models produced by Imperial College London, ICL, the Flaxman et al. Paper suggested that, suddenly, lockdowns reduced the rate of infection by 82%. When a team of German researchers tried to replicate the paper's results, they found that the published conclusions were mainly based on assumptions and circular reasoning. The German academics said, quote, "Purported effects are pure artifacts, which contradict the data. Moreover, we demonstrate that the United Kingdom's lockdown was both superfluous and ineffective," end quote. Researchers from Stanford University said the Flaxman paper was highly misleading and suffered from serious selective reporting, providing the most favorable estimates for lockdown benefits. Turning their attention to the ICL models, the team of epidemiologists at Stanford concluded, quote, "Lockdown appeared the most effective measure to save lives in the original analysis of 11 European countries performed by the Imperial College team. These impacts were highly exaggerated. Claimed effects of lockdowns are grossly overstated. This bias can have devastating implication if it leads to adoption of harmful measures," end quote. Many epidemiologists and other experts were angered by the Flaxman et al. Paper. They made it clear that most governments, the UK's among them, were pursuing NPIs contrary to all epidemiological understanding. In 2006, Professor Donald A. Henderson, the person largely credited with winning the fight against smallpox, published Disease Mitigation Measures in the Control of Pandemic Influenza. His refutation of NPIs noted, quote, "There are no historical observations or scientific studies that support the confinement by quarantine of groups of possibly infected people for extended periods. Such a policy would also be particularly hard on and dangerous to people living in close quarters, where the risk of infection would be heightened. Travel restrictions, such as closing airports and screening travelers at borders, have historically been ineffective. It might mean closing theaters, restaurants, malls, large stores, and bars. Implementing such measures would have seriously disruptive consequences. A manageable epidemic could move toward catastrophe," end quote. In the years since Henderson's 2006 paper, epidemiologists, immunologists, virologists, and public health statisticians have not changed their views, as the WHO's 2019 publication demonstrates. There was no evidence-based reason to change their opinion. The UK government acknowledged and understood all of this. In its 2011 influenza pandemic preparedness strategy, the UK Department of Health, its name at the time, did not recommend any of the NPIs that the government subsequently rolled out for COVID-19. No lockdowns, no masks, except in very rare circumstances, no school closures, and no travel restrictions were advised. The department considered business and economic continuity absolutely essential, for public health reasons as much as any other. Public health officials knew that pointless NPIs would mean, quote, "a manageable epidemic could move toward catastrophe," end quote. As part of that 2011 strategy, the UK government said that vaccine development should be prioritized only, quote, "if it is not possible to limit the spread by achieving herd immunity, where so many people are immune that the disease cannot continue to infect people to maintain itself in the population," end quote. This is what the science of epidemiology suggests to this day. Nothing has changed. Insert image of Professor Knut Witkowski. Professor Knut M. Witkowski is one of the world's leading epidemiologists. He developed the science behind and has coined the term reproduction number, RO. Speaking in April 2020, he said, quote, "With all respiratory diseases, the only thing that stops the disease is herd immunity. About 80% of the people need to have had contact with the virus. We are experiencing all sorts of counterproductive consequences of not well thought through policy. We will see more cases among the elderly. We will see more death because of this social distancing. I have been an epidemiologist for 35 years, and I have been modeling epidemics for 35 years, but it's a struggle to get heard," end quote. Professor Witkowski was censored online and canceled by the MSM for expressing his eminently qualified opinion. The way his voice was suppressed exemplifies how impossible it has been for scientists who question the pseudo-pandemic to reach the public. Policymakers refused to listen, preferring to hear only from the scientists whose work supported their policies. Without any apparent explanation, epidemiology was flipped on its head during the pseudo-pandemic. The resultant MPIs did nothing but deepen the crisis. The UK government reduced NHS capacity and then told citizens they needed to stay home to protect the NHS by flattening the curve. Again, locking down was already known to be both pointless and likely to increase mortality. Nobel chemist and statistician Professor Michael Levitt analyzed the outbreak of COVID-19 in Wuhan from the beginning. He published his findings and reported that infection rates peaked and then started to decrease in Wuhan in early February 2020. He demonstrated from this distribution that he could calculate what the infection and death toll would eventually be, regardless of NPIs. His predictions of around 3,250 deaths and 80,000 infections by mid-March were unerringly accurate. Since the view of Professor Levitt, like that of many other scientists, contradicted the BMGF-funded alarmism of ICL's models that were instrumental in providing alleged justifications for NPIs, his work was censored and removed from search engine results. Shortly after the WHO declared the pseudo-pandemic, then UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson announced the measures the UK government intended to take in response. Those measures included numerous NPIs. The only path offered by the UK government out of the social, economic, and public health disaster that NPIs created was the so-called vaccines. According to the official narrative, vaccines were the only possible salvation from COVID-19. Whenever potential COVID-19 treatments were found, the WHO and governments around the world ensured that they wouldn't be adopted. Protecting vaccine development superseded saving lives. The reality on the ground, the damage supposedly caused by COVID-19 was overwhelmingly the direct result of the policy decision to use NPIs. The catastrophe this would cause was already understood and entirely predictable. Catastrophe was actively pursued by the policymakers. In announcing that it had decided to ignore established epidemiology, the UK government, like many other governments, simultaneously claimed that all of its decisions were led by science. However, given that this science was actually contrary to the prevailing science, we must ask, where did it come from, and who were the scientists pushing it? At this point, you may be asking still another question. What has any of this got to do with Professor Fry and BBC programming? BBC Contagion and the Haslemere Experiment. Unvaccinated is hardly the first questionable documentary the BBC has broadcast. In 2018, it produced another called Contagion, the BBC4 Pandemic. The program chronicled the activities of Professor Fry as she presented the public face of a BBC data harvesting operation that began in 2017. In preparation for Contagion, the BBC commissioned the development and rollout of a smartphone app. Quote, "The pandemic app has been created as part of a BBC citizen science event that aims to identify the human networks and behaviors that spread infectious diseases. end quote. The idea was that the GPS location of the app users would be tracked and contact between users recorded. A large database of people's movements and interactions would be created, enabling mathematicians, statisticians, and data modelers to create simulacra of epidemics and pandemics. The BBC added, quote, "We hope the research will benefit everyone in the UK by helping plan for future outbreaks. This anonymous information will be stored on secure servers and only accessed by the app developers and the researchers." End quote. An excellent researcher, called Pig Huey, pointed out the key objective of the BBC experiment, as stated in its own About the App description. Quote, "The data collected between December 2017 and December 2018 will contribute to this new gold standard set for use in future simulations and in wider pandemic research." End quote. In other words, the data harvested by the BBC was intended to create simulated, not real, pandemics. This may seem obvious, but it is key to understanding the impact that BBC's pandemic dataset would have. This was not a model of a pandemic based upon real-world data, but rather a mathematical construct dependent upon assumed epidemiological inputs. The BBC also said of this app, quote, "The BBC Pandemic app received an Invest Northern Ireland grant for research and development," end quote. Invest Northern Ireland, INI, is a part of the UK government's Department for the Economy. INI says of itself that its purpose is to provide strong government support, focused upon delivering the government's economic development strategies. The BBC went on to say, quote, "The study is funded by the BBC and organized by the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, LSHTM, and University of Cambridge, in collaboration with app developers Big Motive and Program Makers 360 Production." End quote. The fact that the UK government and the BBC invested in the data gathering project means that the effort was paid for by UK taxpayers and license fee payers. Insert image of Julia Gogg. The experience benefited Big Motive, the BBC's app developer. Big Motive subsequently produced the UK's first COVID-19 contact tracing app in Northern Ireland, the Stop COVID NI app. Similarly, the eventual NHS test and trace app for England and Wales was in part developed by Zuka Engineering, whose UK academic partners are Imperial College London, ICL, and the University of Cambridge, UOC. Again, it seems that UOC's collaboration with the BBC and the UK government in the contagion experiment proved valuable for Zuka. As we shall see, the BBC pandemic dataset certainly did. The Surrey town of Haslemere was carefully selected as the epicenter of the simulated outbreak, with Professor Fry playing the role of patient zero. The choice of Haslemere initially led to some consternation among the mathematicians involved in the modeling. In an article published in the Journal of Epidemics, Professor Julia Gogg said, quote, "In the TV program, we first simulated a detailed outbreak in the town of Haslemere, and this was to be the seed of the national outbreak. In particular, we were asked to ensure that the epidemic was seeded in Haslemere. It is commonly believed that these epidemics establishment sites are likely to be major population centers. While the single introduction in Haslemere may be contrived, there is also no reason to reject the possibility of a major outbreak being introduced in such a town." End quote. Professor Gogg has never disclosed who it was that insisted the BBC's fake pandemic should be contrived to start in the relatively small town of Haslemere. We might suspect that the request came from either the BBC or the government. Both, after all, were paying for the research. It is almost an incalculable coincidence that the next pandemic in the UK, called COVID-19, supposedly broke out in Haslemere. The first patient in the UK to be treated for COVID-19 was a man who flew in from China, but the first supposed UK infection befell a man who, remarkably, lived in Hazelmere. The BBC reported that he was from Surrey, yet didn't think it worth mentioning the town he lived in. The local press, for whom Professor Fry's 2018 contagion experiment had been a big deal, did think it interesting, calling the coincidence bizarre. Surrey Live wrote, quote, "The coronavirus outbreak in Hazelmere has thrown up a bizarre coincidence to a BBC four experiment series that was also filmed in the town 2 years ago. The outbreak in the Surrey town has drawn spooky comparisons to the program Contagion, the BBC four pandemic, which aired in March 2018. The confirmed case on Friday, February 28th, was the first patient to have contracted the virus from within the UK," end quote. Just as the BBC's Contagion team modeled. The BBC pandemic dataset, as referenced in Klepek et al. 2018, enthused statisticians and mathematical modelers around the globe. Researcher Pikui tracked down footage of Professor Gogg speaking in 2017 prior to Contagion, explaining the reason for their excitement. Quote, "This is the big one for us. This dataset will be made available to all scientists. I don't know anything like it, so there is a lot of interest from colleagues who have got in touch, asking for access to the data, asking, is there anything other people can have? And it's like, yeah, you can have all of it. Off you go, and it will be the BBC pandemic dataset." End quote. This anonymized dataset has been publicly available since 2020 and available to the global scientific community since 2018. Encouraged by its initial success with the app in Hazelmere, the BBC began the second phase of its data-gathering experiment. This time, it rolled the app out nationally. Aiming to recruit at least 10,000 people, the BBC successfully enrolled nearly 29,000. In Contagion, Professor Fry claimed that the data would enable scientists to predict the impact of various non-pharmaceutical interventions, NPIs. "What's so exciting about the data we have gathered is that mathematicians can now use it to test a range of interventions. What if we closed schools? How would that impact the number of people infected? And shutting down places where people gather or asking them to stay at home. Now that we have this data, there are all manner of possibilities that could be tested." Fry opined, quote, "The BBC four pandemic experiment has created a valuable legacy. We now have a new gold standard dataset for pandemic research. A vast amount of information that will be shared with mathematicians from the Department of Health and pandemic researchers nationwide. Better models mean better healthcare for all of us," end quote. BBC 4's Contagion experiment with Professor Hannah Fry was more than 70 minutes long. It had plenty of time to mention sharing the data with the UK government, but did not do so until the last minute. Encouraging as many people as possible to download the BBC's Forerunner to the Track and Trace apps, Professor Fry concluded the program by claiming that the BBC and the Contagion team had helped to unleash, quote, "the life-saving power of mathematics on what the government considers the greatest threat to our society," end quote. We should ask if it was not, in fact, the BBC and the subsequent exploitation of the Contagion experiment by the UK government that created the greatest threat to our society. Insert image of multiple fries. The BBC pandemic dataset model. The harvested dataset enabled the BBC Contagion team to model a national pandemic and to claim various benefits for NPIs. This virtual reality simulation assumed a set of disease characteristics. They assumed the disease was spread through asymptomatic transmission. Professor Fry said, quote, "You can be infectious for a whole day without feeling ill, meaning you can carry on about your normal everyday business without realizing that you're spreading a disease," end quote. The team assumed a high and consistent reproduction number, or RO value, of 1.8. This refers to the number of other people a single infected person infects. The assumption in the model was that one person infects 1.8 others. Thus, as more people were infected, they each spread the disease asymptomatically. The rate of growth was fixed and, assuming no one was immune, drove the simulated contagion unendingly. Starting their simulation in Hazelmere, assuming an RO of 1.8 and almost instant asymptomatic transmission with no possible immunity, the BBC plugged its app data into its model. It predicted 43 million infections and assumed every one of those would result in illness and could therefore legitimately be called a case. The BBC also assumed a worst-case scenario, case fatality rate, CFR, of 2%, and predicted 900,000 deaths in less than 9 months. Following the worst-case scenario predictions, Dr. Adam Kucharski from the LSHTM speculated that the next pandemic would be a zoonotic virus that might break out in rural Southeast Asia. The prediction of a zoonotic virus was reinforced by Professor Wendy Barclay from Imperial College London. Professor Barclay also explained how mutation of spike proteins could leave us with no immunity to new strains. Dr. Chloe Selwood, head of pandemic planning for NHS England, spoke about how the NHS would cope if the worst-case scenario occurred. Quote, "So if you think about 50% of the population being affected, if all of those cases happened in 1 week, that's a really big, short, sharp peak. Lots of cases. If we can slow the spread over a much longer period, that reduces the impact on the NHS and makes it much more manageable." End quote. Her concerns were echoed by Dr. Chris Chiu, a researcher for Imperial College London, who said that pandemics were regular occurrences. He stated, "What we saw from the last flu pandemic in 2009, which was a relatively mild disease, was that our health service was almost unable to cope. In truth, there was no 2009 pandemic. There were just 18,500 confirmed H1N1 influenza deaths globally. It didn't even constitute a bad flu season." During contagion, Professor Gok spoke to Professor Fry about targeting vaccination of alleged super spreaders. All this chatter was based upon the assumption that infection is asymptomatic and practically instant. Professor Fry suggested, quote, "So if you take those out, vaccinate them so they are immune to the virus and see how it changes," end quote. Assuming that vaccination would stop transmission, Professor Gog adjusted the simulation and Professor Fry concluded that targeting just 10% of alleged super spreaders would reduce infection rates by 40%. She added, quote, "Our app enabled us to identify super spreaders in Hazelmere, but in the real world, people who work in busy places like schools could also be super spreaders," end quote. Professor Gog then simulated the impact that handwashing could have in the faux pandemic. Gog's subsequent model produced results that suggested handwashing could save 13 million lives and slow the transmission of an airborne respiratory virus. This led Professor Fry to conclude, quote, "If we all commit to changing our behavior, there are ways to slow the pandemic," end quote. Summary of the BBC contagion model. A zoonotic virus emerges in Southeast Asia. It soon spreads to the UK, where the first domestic infection is identified in Hazelmere. From Hazelmere, as a consequence of asymptomatic transmission and a high RO, the contagion spreads around the UK, striking the major urban areas first and hardest. Super spreaders create hotspots of infection that rapidly overwhelm health services. No one is immune. Contagion is more or less instant, and infection and transmission are asymptomatic. Consequently, just being infected makes you a case of the disease, symptoms or not. The only hope is a vaccine that stops transmission of the virus, but the virus mutates into potentially more dangerous forms, variants. Due to the high death rate, until a life-saving vaccine stops infection and transmission, the people need to follow government orders, change their behavior, and commit to using NPIs. Measures that could be useful focus upon slowing the spread, flattening the curve, in order to protect the NHS. Other suggested measures could include telling people to stay at home, lock down, shutting down places where people gather, social distancing, or closing schools and businesses. Hand washing, hand space space, could also flatten the curve and reduce the spread of an airborne respiratory virus. Sound familiar? Who used the BBC's dataset and the model? Throughout pseudopandemic, the UK government said it took its scientific advice from the Scientific Advisory Group for Emergencies, SAGE. In 2021, Professor Gogg spoke about how the BBC pandemic dataset was used and by whom. She revealed that the Scientific Pandemic Influenza Group on Modeling, SPIM, the predictive modeling team within SAGE, picked up the dataset and was looking at her research in 2018, following the BBC's experiment. The World Health Organization declared a global pandemic on the 11th of March, 2020, but SPIM had already been modeling future pandemics, using the BBC data, for more than a year. Professor Gogg also spoke about her own participation in SPIM and SAGE that began in February 2020. She noted, quote, SPIM was all about gearing up for having the modeling groups at the ready in the case of a pandemic. With COVID-19, a lot of people are asymptomatic, and there are other diseases which look like COVID-19. So you've got to have testing. Some types of tests have imperfect sensitivity, so even understanding surveillance of the current situation has been surprisingly complex. We'd guessed already that time that closing schools would do immense harm to children, and now the evidence for that is much clearer. End quote. SPIM was focused on predictive models that could inform policy decisions. In February 2020, shortly after she joined SPIM, Professor Gogg gave an interview to the Centre International des Rencontres Mathématiques, CRIM, in which she revealed more about how SPIM was working during the pandemic. Professor Gogg acknowledged the paucity of empirical data SPIM could access. She seemed uneasy. Quote, it might be more comfortable for us to say, we don't have enough data, we can't do this, but we should try and do what we can. End quote. Insert image of Wendy Barclay. Professor Gogg was an academic caught in a dilemma. Her expertise was in constructing models from empirical data. Once in SPIM, however, she was asked to produce models based upon little evidence, predicting empirical data, a very different position. Given what we now know about the harm caused to children by the lockdown measures, for example, the professor's discomfort was understandable. But it is not as if these harms were unknown. Many warned about them prior to any decision being made to shut schools. Professor Gogg wasn't the only scientist involved in the BBC contagion experiment, who later advised the government as a member of SAGE. Professor Wendy Barclay, SAGE, and Dr. Adam Kucharski, SAGE and SPIM, joined her. Dr. Chloe Selwood became a member of the New and Emerging Respiratory Virus Threats Advisory Group, NERVTAG. Many of the first to write papers based upon the BBC pandemic dataset also advised the UK government's COVID-19 response. Dr. Petra Klepek, SPIM and TCF, Dr. Stefan Kissler, SPIM, Dr. Joshua Firth, SPIM, and Dr. Lewis Spergen, SPIM, added to the group of scientists who based their advice upon the BBC pandemic dataset. But what did this advice amount to? In 2009, the UK government's senior scientific advisor on the misuse of drugs, Professor David Newt, was effectively sacked by then Labour Home Secretary Alan Johnson. Newt was forced to resign after he delivered a briefing paper in which he said that the scientific evidence showed that LSD, ecstasy, and cannabis were less harmful than tobacco and alcohol. Newt's crime was not that he was wrong, but that he had questioned the government. His scientific advice had damaged the government's policy decision to give the public clear messages about the dangers of drugs. It didn't matter to the government that its advice and prohibition policies were causing harm to public health. It mattered only that its pet scientist had undermined its authority. As pointed out by Professor Andrew Maynard, quote, perhaps Newt's greatest crime is that he sincerely and altruistically, I believe, tried to speak truth to power. He attempted to provide decision-makers with a sound scientific and evidence-based foundation on which to base policies that would improve people's lives. His downfall was that he was working with a government that seems to believe in speaking power to truth rather than truth to power, deciding what is right first, then bolstering this up with evidence. End quote. Hypothesis. In 2018, using data they started gathering in 2017, the BBC modeled the future UK pseudo-pandemic in minute detail, right down to where it allegedly began. Many will argue that this is to be expected. The scientists knew what they were doing and their predictions turned out to be accurate. That is possible, though the Hazelmere coincidence stretches plausibility beyond breaking point. There is another major problem with that argument. The BBC contagion team did not predict a real pandemic. They modeled a fake pandemic based upon epidemiological assumptions that do not match the subsequent empirical data observed during the COVID-19 disease outbreak. Asymptomatic transmission, no possible immunity, a persistently high RO, all infections leading to cases, high disease mortality, and near-instant infection and transmission were not features of COVID-19 epidemiology. COVID-19, symptomatic illness, did not spread through populations like wildfire. Only a few were affected, most were not. So if the dynamics of COVID-19 were completely different from those assumed in the contagion model, how is it possible that the supposed COVID-19 pandemic appears to have been practically identical to the fake one made up by the BBC in 2018, right down to where it began? The BBC's model mirrored the pseudo-pandemic because the MSM and the government portrayed the COVID-19 pandemic as described by the model, not by the empirical data. There may well have been a novel respiratory disease making the rounds. Some will say even this isn't true. But given all we know now, it is evident that the pandemic narrative we were told to unquestioningly accept is the fictional one broadcast by the BBC in 2018. To further substantiate this hypothesis, consider this. The NPIs that were foisted upon us all had no epidemiological basis. There was no aspect of the COVID-19 disease that warranted any of the NPIs that were deployed. Again, the use of NPIs was only suggested by the models, most specifically by the BBC's contagion model, and later by Imperial College's Report 9, which was yet another model. Earlier we asked who the scientists were who were pushing the science that ran contrary to all known epidemiology. We've just listed some of the many scientists involved with the BBC contagion experiment who worked with the BBC pandemic dataset and were selected by the government to allegedly provide it with advice. They weren't chosen simply because they were leading scientists. They were chosen because they were already working on scientific research that the government could exploit to justify policy decisions it had already taken. NPIs were the objective, not the response. COVID-19 was the excuse, not the cause. Government policies caused the turmoil and misery that the vast majority perceived to be a pandemic. Government policies increased mortality risk for the most vulnerable and perpetuated the myth of a rampant disease. The government turned a relatively minor disease outbreak into a catastrophe. The government invested in the BBC's contagion experiment and then used the subsequent science to simulate a national pandemic. It was a pseudo-pandemic designed with the complicity of the BBC, which then acted as one of the government's leading propagandists, selling the model it created to a terrified public. Insert image of Ian Davis's pseudo-pandemic. Free to subscribers at iandavis.com. Conclusion. There is no criticism of the principle of vaccination made in this series of articles. To question the COVID jabs is not to question vaccination as a potentially useful public health strategy. There may be questions to be asked about vaccine schedules, but they are not asked here. The BBC's Unvaccinated with Professor Hannah Fry was a disgraceful piece of propagandist junk. The BBC set out to deceive its audience and promote government policy, and that is all that its program achieved. The whole premise of the so-called debate, that the majority of the population need to take the jabs, but that some refuse to do so, was a lie. The vast majority of those who chose not to take the jab didn't need one in the first place. Unfortunately, the injected were predominantly coerced. Coercion was the basis of the so-called vaccine's widespread adoption. The program presented by Professor Fry was scientifically illiterate. It denied the scientific principle of doubt and omitted all evidence that undermined its propagandist message. There was no debate, no exploration, and no value in it for anyone except the pharmaceutical corporations and the government. The BBC had no right to deceive the public by claiming that Professor Fry helped bring the UK out of its first lockdown. Nothing could be further from the truth. It is truly amazing that the UK public continues to pay for propaganda through the BBC license fee. The people face a crushing cost of living crisis that, despite attempts to blame everything on the Ukraine conflict, began long before the 2020 pseudo-pandemic. That cost of living crisis was exacerbated by another NPI, as the government printed money like confetti to fund an unemployed populace, a populace locked up and isolated in their homes. The majority have already sacrificed many of their freedoms on the altar of the new normal. When the heating is rationed this winter, we might wonder what else people will forego to afford to watch their tell-lie vision.